Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. So glad you could join us today. The mental health of children, teenagers, and young adults is in a state of emergency, and not just here in Minnesota, but nationwide. Major medical groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics sounded the alarm back in October of 2021. But surveys conducted well before the COVID-19 pandemic showed teenagers were reporting mental health concerns at a higher rate than previous years. In 2009, a quarter of teenagers reported persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness. 10 years later, it was more than a third. And in 2021, the CDC said that 44% of teenagers say they feel sad or hopeless. On yesterday's show, American Public Media's Call to Mind initiative explored the mental health experiences of young people across the nation, and it took a close look at the role of schools on the front lines of helping kids in distress. This hour, I'm continuing that conversation. I'll talk with three guests about how the mental health crisis is affecting Minnesota youth. And we want to hear your stories. Are you the parent or guardian of a young person who is struggling right now? Are you worried about your child? Or are you a young person who is struggling? What support do you need from the adults in your life? Talk to us about it. The phone lines are open. You can call at 651-227-6000. Again, the number is 651-227-6000. You can also call 800-242-2828 or tweet me. I'm at Angela Davis, MPR. Let me bring in our guests. We have with us in the studio, Sandy Levandusky. Sandy is the superintendent of Intermediate District 287, which serves 11 districts in the West Metro. District 287 schools serve students with high emotional and behavioral needs through instruction that centers on healing and responding to trauma. Hi, Sandy.
Good morning.
Also with us is Daniel Newitz. Daniel is the legislative chair of the Minnesota School Psychologists Association. He's also a licensed psychologist. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
Also here in the studio, we have Sierra Grandy. Sierra is a volunteer with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Minnesota. She facilitates several peer support groups through NAMI. Hello, Sierra.
Good morning.
So we know that the number of young people who are struggling right now is really striking. And as I just said in the introduction, just last year, 44% of teenagers reported to the CDC that they feel hopeless or depressed. And so, Sandy, what goes through your mind when you hear that?
For an intermediate district like mine, and there are four intermediate districts in the metro area, it tells me that our students who are the highest need of that 45% are in incredible distress and often are not able to have their needs met and often don't have the words to describe what they need. So for us, it's been an incredibly challenging period during COVID and this year, more so than ever.
And so when we use words like in distress or when I say struggling, what does that mean? What does that look like? What are some of the behaviors we're talking about? Because if they're not talking about it, how do you know?
Again, we serve the highest need students in our intermediate program. And for us, we're seeing experiences like kids actually trying to take their life in school during the school day. We see kids, little kids, who are exhibiting incredible behavior that's assaultive sometimes to our staff. We're seeing little kids exhibiting sexualized behavior in the classroom. Those are all signs of our students being in acute distress because of what they've experienced.
And so if you work in that school setting, what is the impact on the staff?
This has been, I'm sure our staff would say, the hardest year of their professional careers. We see staff who have been assaulted and are resigning. We see staff who are suffering from trauma, from what they're hearing and seeing our kids experiencing. We see staff who are under-resourced from a mental health standpoint and are having to step in and be that person to the students who come through our doors.
As we have this conversation this hour, you're going to hear me give out this information a couple of times because it's important for you to know. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, you can contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And here is the phone number. It's 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. Again, that is 800-273-8255. Or you can use the crisis text line by texting HOME, H-O-M-E, to this number, 741-741. Again, that's the crisis text line. Text HOME to 741-741. Sierra, you work in peer support groups. Tell me your thoughts about hearing that 44% of teenagers are reporting they feel hopeless or depressed.
Life's been heavy lately, and teenagers have access to information unlike any generation before us. Unfortunately, I'm not surprised by it, but I've been through that, and that is a hard feeling to go through. We have a lack of resources in our schools and in the community, so when people are finally asking for help, there's not the people there to actually provide the help. So then the adults are trying their best to mitigate risk. And so for the 44%, that's a lot of kids. And that is, mental illnesses or medical illnesses that can become life-threatening. And that is a scary percentage to hear.
You're in your late 20s.
I am.
And so when you're sitting in these groups and having conversations with teenagers, you know, how do you approach that? Is it that you begin just with eye contact? Do you share your own story? How do you connect with them to get them to talk to you?
I share my own story, which I'm very open about, because I think that that is one of the quickest ways for somebody to know that I've been in a similar situation. My mental health struggle started when I was 11. I called the police on myself because of suicidality, because I was from a rural town. And at that point, it was, if your life is in danger, call 911.
You understood that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have a lot of better resources out there now. Mm-hmm. And 988, which I'll talk about a bit later, will be coming out. But I share my story because it's important for people to know that I get it.
Mm-hmm. And you were actually hospitalized when you were...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I ended up having to go over 2 hours away. And that was back when there were more beds available. Right now, because of COVID, there has been a lot of resource shifting. And I, at 13, and that was one of many hospitalizations. I spent much of my childhood in and out of hospitals, suffering from suicidality and generalized anxiety disorder, and then bipolar type 2 was the diagnosis they landed on. At 13, I was inpatient at a residential treatment home, which has since been closed because of a lack of resources. And at 18, while I was still in high school, they started electroconvulsive therapy, which is shock therapy. I'm in recovery now, and I am a mental health advocate, and I try to give a little bit of hope that things can get better, but there's also a cliche there because life is still heavy and I feel my symptoms every day.
And in many ways, you are such a success story and inspiration because you completed college. And are you in law school now?
I'm in law school now, yes.
Right. And why law?
Law is something that, that's a question everyone's asking, but it's above everything. The law gives the funding for the programs. The law is what writes the statutes. The law is what prioritizes everything. And it is almost like a different language and mm-hmm. is one that I could not read. So I wanted to learn more so I could make a bigger difference in the community.
I'm glad you're here and I'm glad you're sharing your story.
Thank you.
Daniel, you're a school psychologist. As we talk about the percentage of teenagers saying, you know, they're hopeless and depressed, 44% now reporting that in a survey. What goes through your mind when you hear that?
Yeah, well, what I hear in that, first of all, is that we have had some issues that have been exacerbated by a pandemic and by other variables, including the death of George Floyd. It's important to recognize that we preceded those moments with issues around student mental health that were already growing very concerning. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at percentages like 44% and we think about how do we intervene with that from a school perspective, it's very challenging because typically how we look at tiered services or how we address student needs, because mental health isn't just responding to intensive needs of students. It's about being preventative at a universal level and then having targeted intervention and then having intensive intervention. And so our school's capacity and the ability to meet the needs, intensive needs of 44% of students is extremely limited. And so this conversation quickly becomes a conversation about resource allocation and how can we fund and resource our schools in a way that would allow us to honor and dignify the scope of what 44% of our students struggling really means.
So we know that the school setting, like, that's ideal because it creates more opportunities. It makes mental health care more accessible to students, right? Mm-hmm. But we also know there are not enough mental health professionals in schools. Mm-hmm. To throw some more information here, we know there's a huge shortage of school mental health workers across the nation, Minnesota no exception. The American School Counselors Association recommends a 250-to-1 ratio of students to school counselors. And last school year, Minnesota's ratio of students to counselors was 398-to-1. What are some of the reasons for this shortage of mental health workers, particularly in schools, among, you know, having counselors, social workers, psychologists? What's your understanding, Daniel?
I think it's complex, and there is some degree to it which it's specific to the different roles. But the issue that you mentioned about counselors, the recommended ratio being 1 to 250, I know the national average for counselors is 1 to 424. Mm. And in 2019, the ratio for counselors in, to a student in Minnesota was 1 to every 630. And so we have the third worst counselor-to-student ratio in the country. For school psychologists, the recommended ratio is 1 to 500, and we have over 1,100 students for every school psychologist in Minnesota. And so these recommended ratios, by the way, these are about having not necessarily even an ideal working environments, but really just something that is functional. And so when we look at something as that is functional, and we look how far away we are from that functional space, it speaks to how mental health issues have grown because we are not providing ourselves with the capacity to address these issues in a preventative and a responsive manner. And so looking at these shortages, I think it's really a matter of will and it's a matter of policy and financing. And so it's an issue that we need to take on. And it's about investment in public education and specifically investment in the capacity through personnel and specifically student support personnel.
Sandy, anything you want to add to that as you look at your district and the number of schools that you are working with?
Yeah, certainly that what was just said is pertinent to our special education programs. And most of our students are identified as high need special education students, setting four students, if you will. But for us, in addition, what we need beyond school psychologists is really embedded clinical mental health services and ones that are culturally relevant and providers representing the races of our students. One example I can give you is that we are lobbying very hard for is an intensive program that we partner with the Wilder Foundation, where we have the equivalent of a residential treatment mental health provider in our district for our elementary and middle school students. We can't find residential treatment beds right now, and that's been alluded to already. Mm-hmm. So I've been urging policymakers to pivot and consider putting and funding that type of treatment program in school, because that's where the kids are at. That's where the families are needing help. And so it's a major public policy issue and a funding issue this legislative session in Minnesota.
I want to remind you that we're talking about the mental health crisis that we're seeing among children and teenagers and young adults. It's been described as a state of emergency. And the question is, are you the parent or guardian of a young person who is struggling? Are you worried about a child in your life? Or are you a young person who is struggling? Have you tried helping a friend who is? What support do you need from the adults in your life? You can call us at 651-227-6000. Or 800-242-2828 as I talk with three guests. Let's open the phone lines and talk to some of our listeners. In Rochester right now, we have Sarah on the phone. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. What did you want to tell us?
Well, I was telling your person that I work in a small school district in southeastern Minnesota, and I work in our ALC health office. I'm a health aide there, and it just hurts my heart that I have so many students coming into my office, probably a couple a day. It's a really small district. We have about 70 kids enrolled in our ALC, and sometimes they're just coming in because they need to lay down and get away and take a short nap, or they need, you know, they just need to talk things out, or, and it's hard because there's only so much I can do, and we do have a full-time school counselor. We have a social worker that goes between two of our buildings with our setting four, and then we also have an in-house therapist that works through an outside agency. So between all of us, it's just there's so many needs, and I worry about them as we go into summer because a lot of them won't be in school and those supports mm-hmm. won't be there for them. And mm-hmm. how do we support them? I have a teenager myself, so I often think about her and what she's going through. She talks about her friends that are just hurting right now.
Thank you. That's Sarah calling in from Rochester. She talked about worrying, and she talked about young people hurting. Sierra, in one of your roles at NAMI, you facilitate these peer support groups for young people. What are you hearing from young people right now? That caller, she talked about, you know, just sometimes in the school day, they just need a break. They're asking for, like, can I just have a moment?
Well, I see that a lot of young people, and I'm at that point where I'm not quite a young person anymore, but I'm still in the age range a little bit. But we're always connected, and we see all of the trauma in the world all the time right now. And there's this helplessness mm-hmm. that gets heavy and starts to drain somebody's light. And I see that a lot in young people, especially where they want to make a difference. They want to feel like they have a purpose, but then they have no power to do much at all.
Tell me more about it feels heavy.
That's one of the best ways I've been able to explain at least my own depression. Mm-hmm. It gives a like tangible feeling of what like that stone in your heart feels like mm-hmm. after things are too much, the world gets too loud, mm-hmm. and it is hard to navigate a learning environment or social environments when you feel like that. And with 44% of mm-hmm. teens feeling like that, it's hurting a lot of people trying to be their best selves, but not having the resources or the capacity to do so.
Right. We've heard many people describe, you know, when kids are hurting, they're not learning.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so if you are a parent or, you know, just an adult who is concerned, like, what do you do? I mean, beyond conversation, I mean, what do you think is immediately helpful?
That really depends on the situation with the kid. Because for me, I imploded. That was my way of, like, dealing with my mental health. It would get really bad inside, and then I'd ask for help. Mm-hmm. And luckily, when I was younger, the help was there to a point where I was almost over-treated. And now we're seeing the opposite. I was privileged. We've had many, many communities for this entire time that are completely underserved. There's no right answer mm-hmm. to what kids need, but a lot of the time it's just listening, like hear yeah. them out, right. because they do know what they need.
And Daniel, do you have any advice? I mean, I think there are many adults who have a very heightened awareness of this, but, you know, are wondering what to do.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, there's no substitute for having connections and centering student voice and family and community voice in these moments. Because when we look at societal variables that impact mental health, we can often arrive at, well, what's the issue? And we can do some professional learning and reading books, and we should do those things, to be clear, right? But none of that is a substitute for understanding how that's impacting the students that I'm interacting with every day. And mm-hmm. so there is this need in our schools for us to move past a traditional model of parent involvement, which is we call parents when there's a problem and invite them in, or we ask them to volunteer at events. And we need to look at how we diversify the roles of parents and students and authentically center their voices and not just do listening sessions that don't necessarily go anywhere. And so that we can understand what they're experiencing locally and address those through resource allocation that is specific to what we're hearing from our communities.
And Sandy, you know, I listened to Sierra and I'm watching Sierra describe feeling heavy and imploding. And so my instinct is like, I want a hug. Well, these kids need more than a hug. So what do you say to parents or people who are asking, like, what can they do?
Yeah, I think one example that came to mind in this part of the discussion is a parent of a student with severe autism whose regular behavior in general, regular patterns have been totally disrupted by the pandemic. But one day she called me when I called for a online day because we were having bad weather, and the parent was in a lot of distress about that. And as we talked, what I learned from her is she was terrified for her son, who now would have a day where his regular pattern was totally taken away from him. And when that happens for this student, he becomes very aggressive toward her and her daughter in their single family lifestyle. And she did not know what she was going to do on this bad weather day because I had called for an online day. And one thing we failed to understand is this ripple effect to the other parts of the family. And for her, this was a crisis that we were having an online day. So we need to get more services to all kinds of families. But in this particular situation, she doesn't have access to a quality crisis home that she can at least consider for her mm-hmm. son. She doesn't have access to the kind of comprehensive family supports that she needs to just exist in this day-to-day pattern she's in with her son. So that ripple effect of families can be catastrophic.
I want to open the phone lines and talk to more of our listeners as we talk about the mental health crisis we're seeing with children and teenagers and young adults and how we are responding to it here in Minnesota. So my question is, are you the parent or guardian of a young person who is struggling? Are you worried about your child, or are you a young person who is having a really hard time right now? You could call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Let's take a phone call from Cottage Grove, and Tammy is on the phone. Tammy, thank you for waiting, and what did you want to share with us?
Hello. Thank you for having this conversation. We lost our son to suicide last month, and I so appreciate the talk about what schools can do, because despite really having access to really great medical treatments and having an inpatient hospitalization and then a intensive partial hospitalization and a return to school, our son we thought was doing well and then it took his life, died by suicide in our home. And there weren't a lot of warning signs, I would say. We thought he was doing better, and, you know, we of course reflect on the weekend before he died, and he was happy and eating and singing and doing the things that his vivacious personality led him to do. But I also want to talk about how painful it is to talk about suicide being preventable. My wife adopted Kanae when he was just 3 months old. He was her biological great nephew, and she's American Indian. And Kanae was a person of color. He was very brown, and he had an afro, and had experienced a lot of racism online during video gaming, and encountered that, and then was at home the school year prior to this one. We did all virtual due to COVID, and it was difficult for him because he was a very extroverted person, and the return to school was different. It was new kids, and he was trying to figure out who he was. And he also had, you know, was prenatally drug exposed, had a very impulsive brain, had very severe ADHD, which was treated with meds. I really feel like he got you know, excellent care we were able to because of our resources. I'm a nurse, access really good mental health care, but it wasn't enough for him.
Tammy, I want you to stay on the line here as we talk to you and with you. And first, just want to say I'm so sorry for the loss of your son. And thank you for listening and calling in and sharing what you're going through right now. And Tammy, stay with us because I want to have each of our guests maybe talk to you here for a moment. First, Daniel, as a psychologist, what do you hear in what Tammy's describing about her son?
Yeah, well, Tammy, first of all, let me also express how sorry we are to hear about this, your son's passing. That's a situation that is unimaginable. Unfortunately, it is an experience that we're hearing about in schools throughout our state. And that can be very difficult, especially when you talk about the complex number of variables that are contributing to a student struggling. And I know you mentioned a number of them, one of them being related to race and racism. And I want to mention that we cannot have a conversation about mental health services in schools without having a conversation about race. These are not separate conversations, and these absolutely play a role with one another. It sounds like there was a lot of resources that were allocated. Ultimately, those were not enough in this situation. And so we do need to look at how we can enhance our systems and capacities and look at how we're assessing in an ongoing way, because we cannot, as schools and as broader systems, rely solely upon parents looking for signs that are good or bad and then making calls solely upon those just anecdotal instances. We need to be checking in with our students. We need to be assessing their needs in an ongoing manner because we need to be able to catch these things, especially when they are seemingly unpredictable and so devastating.
And Tammy, again, you said he seemed to be in good spirits in the days before you lost him.
He was taking his medication. Like, we were closely monitoring that. He had a therapist who was Native American, and his therapist too, when we called him, was shocked. That's why I think it's so, and I appreciate what Daniel said about it being multifactorial, we know he was loved, and he knew he was loved and he loved us. And I don't think he could imagine how devastating this would be for our family. Like, we haven't, our 17-year-old son found him. And so, we were able to get into trauma therapists and work through this, but it's, it blew up our whole lives too. And it's, I know this isn't something he would have chosen for us if his brain had been healthy.
Tammy, stay with us. I want Sierra to talk to you for a moment. And Sierra, you do peer support groups. What do you want Tammy to know right now?
Well, first, I'm sorry for your loss. That is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So my first instinct is always to start just shoving resources to people. And so I do want to just quickly say that NAMI has a support group for families. And so being able to talk to other families who've been through this might be helpful. But I also want to say that you did the best you could with the knowledge and resources you had. And as somebody who has attempted suicide, this is not... You didn't do anything wrong, and your family didn't do anything wrong. This is a medical condition that got the life of your son, and I am terribly sorry for that.
Thank you, and I'm really glad you're here.
I want to share this information again. Tammy, stay with us. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Here is the phone number. It's 1-800-273-8255. Again, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. Or you can use the crisis text line. Text the word HOME, H-O-M-E, to the number 741-741. That's HOME to 741-741. That's the crisis text line. Tammy, do you think you could, at this point, talk to other families who've gone through this? Do you think you're able to do that, to be like in a parent peer group?
I don't think we're quite ready to support other people yet, but we've been reaching out for support from there's so many online groups, and the Compassionate Friends has groups for families who've lost children to suicide. So we're accessing a lot of support right now, but we're just really trying to kind of try to put our life back together. And, you know, there is a lot of things, like physical things we had to take care of in terms of prepping our house for sale and finding housing and things like that. So, but in the future, I think we definitely will be able to be a resource to other people.
Tammy, I have one more guest who I want to give an opportunity to talk with you. Sandy, you have worked with families who've gone through this, unfortunately. What would you want Tammy to know?
Tammy, as my colleagues here, I want to offer my condolences to you and the incredible pain that you and your family are going through right now. Over the course of the pandemic, we have lost at least a dozen students of color to suicide, addiction, and police shootings. The pain is everlasting, of course. But I think the important part here that I would say to you and to listeners is racism is so apparent in our country right now. The Buffalo shooting is causing incredible pain and emotional trauma, racial trauma, to everyone in this country who is a person of color, but especially our Black population. Right now, as we speak, my district is organizing affinity groups for both our white and our BIPOC staff to process what is happening so that they can be in the best possible place to help our students process what's happening. Racism and white people in this country are responsible for addressing this.
Right.
And I am dedicating the rest of my career and my retirement career to sending that message. Something has to change in this country.
I want to talk about what we know about, who is most affected by mental health, this crisis. Students of color, according to that CDC survey, students who said they had encountered racism at school reported higher rates of poor mental health. Daniel, can you tell us more about that?
Well, we know that racism and white supremacy play an ongoing role in the symptoms of poor mental health that are experienced by Black students and by other students of color. And I think that you recently had Rezma Menakem on your show, who had talked about our need to be persistent and pervasive in our response to combating white supremacy, as opposed to our tendency to look at it as episodic, and especially as white Minnesotans and white Americans to look at it as episodic. So when we look at these instances in Buffalo or locally with Amir Locke or with George Floyd, I think there's a lot of our population that looks at that and kind of responds to it as though, okay, white supremacy happened again or racism happened again, as opposed to understanding these horrifying instances of violence as symptoms of an ongoing issue that is perpetually felt by our families of color and by our students of color. And so we need to understand how to directly and deliberately talk about race, because mental health services and mental health is a race salient issue, and we cannot combat race salient issues with race neutral responses. And so that's why our schools need to be very deliberate and courageous in approaching mental health with that lens of how racism impacts that work.
Sierra, you're nodding. Anything you want to add to that?
I've just seen that the stigma also is hit even harder for people of color. So there's a stigma around mental illness and talking about your story. But if you're a person of color, that's even harder. And there's less resources that are less trustworthy resources, mm-hmm. where it's more uncomfortable for certain people. If you're trying to get help in an industry that does not have anybody providing the help that looks like you, it feels...
It's even harder.
Right? Yeah, thank you.
To begin that conversation.
Exactly.
As you're starting. All right, well, let's take some more phone calls as we talk about the mental health crisis that we know is happening among children and teenagers and young adults, and how the state is responding to it, the resources that are and are not available. Are you the parent or guardian of a young person who is struggling? Are you yourself struggling and you're, you know, still in school? What support do you need? Call us at 651-227-6000, or you can call 800-242-2828 as I talk with three guests. Let's take a phone call from Minneapolis. Jenny is on the phone. Jenny, thank you for waiting. What do you want to share with us?
Well, thanks so much, number one, for having this program, because it means the world to us parents who are dealing with this. It's so hard to not be emotional about this. I'm the parent of a 12-year-old who is queer, and they started having bullying that happened during COVID, that happened online, that ended up resulting in self-harm behavior that was hidden for a long time until it was it became abundantly clear. And we were really challenged to find resources because my child is 12. They sort of fall in this in-between space where they're not a kid and they're not a teenager. And our experience ended up going to a children's emergency facility, and we ended up in an adult ER for our mental health crisis. And then the resources that I was given were really, I ended up having to patchwork things together to find something where, again, you just talked about how important it is for people to see themselves and their care providers. And for my child, I needed to find someone who was queer to provide them the support that they needed. And that took us months to get to cobble together the care that they needed. They're doing fantastic now. We've just hit a 6-month anniversary with no self-harm, and that is magnificent. That's good news. Mm-hmm. But it is such a challenge to find the correct resources. And then it is heartbreaking to be told that you have to wait months to see a provider. And for kids that are somewhere in between, that they're not at full tilt crisis, but you never know what the internal dialogue is for your child. And so mm-hmm. it could be just the smallest thing that could tip them over into, you know, having that suicide experience so I can't say enough how there is just this lack of information on what do you do when your child has crisis? Where do you go? How do you get the services that you need? And then the providers that we did end up finding, you know, they have magnificent wait lists because there are so many kids who need the care.
Right. Well, Jenny, I'm so encouraged. I'm so happy to hear that your 12-year-old is doing so much better now. And thank you for calling and sharing your story. What Jenny brings up is another point here I have on my list of who is most affected by this mental health crisis. LGBTQ plus students, nearly half, 50% of gay, lesbian, and bisexual teenagers said that they contemplated suicide during the pandemic. That's compared with 14% of their heterosexual peers. Half. Daniel, what do you know about that as a psychologist?
Well, I think it's a matter of being able to, again, we talked about being thoughtful and deliberate about the identities and how those impact the experience of mental health deficits. And that is something that is a responsibility of our schools. If we're going to be addressing mental health services, is to be mindful of how sexual orientation, sexual identity impact a student's experience of school and of broader society, and how that can impact their access to the meaningful resources. It also speaks to, there's a lot in that call that I think talked about the fundamental issues that we're facing right now, because we actually do know a lot of what can help students broadly. And we don't have solutions for everything, but we know what can help. And it's a matter of being able to invest in and allocate resources and have an infrastructure that allows us to allocate those. So we're talking about long wait lists, and we're talking about finding professionals that are appropriate, whether it's their professional orientation or their own identity, which is extremely meaningful. So we need to invest in infrastructure that allows us to build those resources and make them readily available. And then we also need to look at, it goes back to shortages of student support personnel. And specifically, I'll talk about school psychology. So we have school psychology graduate training programs in Minnesota that have an abundance of applicants, and we can't take on all of those applicants because we don't have the resources to take them on. So that's part of our shortage. It's not just there's not the available positions, there's not the available personnel. Mm-hmm. But then also within those training programs, there does need to be a deliberate look at how we're diversifying our work staff. Because when we talk about students interacting with teachers of color, it's not just classroom teachers, it's school psychologists, counselors, nurses, social workers. And so how are, for example, our graduate programs making connections with historically Black colleges and universities? How are they engaging deliberately to recruit and retain candidates that demonstrate a lot of different identities, including queer identities? Mm-hmm. So I think that's central to the issue and how we need to move forward.
Sandy, I have a couple questions for you, but you wanted to pick up on a point Daniel just made.
Yeah, I think your caller makes a good point about how complicated it is for a parent to navigate that system to find mental health resources. I have a colleague who is a very highly respected clinical professional whose own children needed help, and how mm-hmm. she was challenged to navigate that system even mm-hmm. with that knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think it calls for a really thorough public policy to look at mental health, what is needed in our state and our country, and who is responsible for providing it. Right now, it's a combination of things that makes that pathway to service very, very challenging for parents, even with parents who are able to navigate it. And then think about the parents who are struggling with the many issues they may be struggling with. They just give up. They can't navigate the system to get the help their children need.
Sierra, Ginny, that mom who just called in, she talked about her child being bullied and how that led to self-harm. Anything you can share with us about what we know about bullying and self-harm?
I mean, we go back to the identity as well, where you're being bullied for a part of who you are that you didn't have a choice about. It tends to like chip away at your self-esteem, which then makes it you're more susceptible to mental illnesses. And I identify as bisexual. And so seeing how much news there is out there about how that is just not an okay thing to be in certain states, it's hard now as an adult, but as a kid seeing that would feel like there isn't a place to belong. Mm-hmm. And belonging and having friends and having mentors are very important. And once you start like withdrawing, and again, I used the term imploded earlier, mm-hmm. and I feel like that might be projecting, but that's what I heard from that story as mm-hmm. well.
I want to take another phone call as we talk about the mental health crisis that we're seeing among young people. And again, I want to give this information out again, these important phone numbers and this text crisis line. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number is 1-800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255, or go to the crisis text line by texting the word HOME to 741-741. Back to the phone lines. Let's talk to one of our listeners who is in Stillwater. And this is Amy. Good morning, Amy. What do you want to share with us?
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the program today. Sure. I have two twin boys in seventh grade. And for the last 3 years, we've been going through the process of diagnosing one of them with autism and ADHD. In the meantime, COVID hit and online school happened. And I just wanted to say that I feel like, early childhood is supported really well in this state with ECSE, where parents can get together and talk about parenting, and the kids can get together and have playtime and learn. But we don't have that support system for, school-aged children and teenagers. And I wish that we could provide more social interaction on a casual basis for teens to get together and openly talk about these issues that have been discussed already on the radio. There's just, you know, everybody is so pre-planned and so many activities are always, you know, completely planned out, and the kids are really busy trying to catch up with school, and the teachers are stressed because they've been trying to, you know, catch the kids up from having online learning happening. So everyone's pretty much taxed out, and you know, it just doesn't seem like there's enough time to find the resources and spend the time together to strategize on how to help each other.
Thank you. That's Amy calling in from Stillwater. I want to take another phone call, I believe from Minneapolis, where Allie is on the phone. Allie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. And Allie, what do you want to share with us about the mental health crisis we're seeing right now among young people?
Yeah. So I'm a pastor to kids. And so a lot of my work has like shifted towards just focusing on mental health education and that support. But I also have a 5-year-old daughter in preschool in the Minneapolis Public Schools who she was just diagnosed with PTSD and like still processing all of that.
PTSD at 5 years old?
Yes.
And do you know why?
A lot of it has to do with the pandemic and just the disruption since January, really, with distance learning, and then she got COVID herself, more distance learning, and the disruption of the teacher strike. And we're still like in the beginning phases of working with her school to get her the help she needs. But just like imagining it from her perspective as just a little 5-year-old going through all of this, like, oh, and not fully having the words to be able to name what she's feeling is so hard.
Thank you, Allie, for sharing that. I want to talk about solutions. Daniel, in the introduction, I said that you are the legislative chair for the Minnesota School Psychologists Association. What does that role entail, being the legislative chair? And what do you want to see from lawmakers this session to address the youth mental health crisis?
Thank you so much for this question. Yes, I think there's a number of things that we need to take on. And I mentioned earlier in the conversation that we might not have the answer to all of the issues that we're facing, but we do actually know a lot of things that can have a meaningful impact. And so there are policies that are meaningfully being talked about at our state level that will immediately have an impact on students learning and in addressing mental health and addressing closing opportunity gaps, because it's also important to remember that before the pandemic, before George Floyd, we arguably had the worst racial disparities in the country. Before that happened, we were identifying students with disabilities at a significantly higher rate than the national average. And so things like increasing teachers of color, which I know there's legislation to pursue that, increasing student support personnel. So when we talk about counselor shortages, school psychologists, social workers, and school nurses, we need more of those in our schools to address students' needs. And we also need a lot of items around infrastructure. And so I know on yesterday's program, Call to Mind, there was a discussion about multi-tiered systems of support, which is basically saying mental health is intensive needs, and we've talked a lot about those intensive needs, but it is also universal instruction, and it is targeted intervention. And so we can be preventative. We don't have to wait until students develop needs that are all of a sudden demanding that we access these most intensive needs. And some students will need those, to be clear, but we are exhausting those intensive resources by failing to invest in preventative services. And so I hope that our state Congress has the courage and the will to see public schools as a space that can be productive, and that we can do this differently. We can invest in student support personnel and these other items, and we can do better. But it's just a matter of, do we care about what happens to the kids in our community? And go ahead, please.
I was going to say, Sandy, you went down to the state capitol. You told them about it. You testified to state lawmakers asking them to increase the funding for mental health supports in schools. What did you say to them?
I think the main message I gave was examples of what we were experiencing and reminded them of the testimony that I've given for a number of years, mm-hmm. that unless we do the preventative mental health care, unless we invest in adaptive models, we will see the kinds of things that unfortunately we saw in my district this year, which was a school shooting mm-hmm. where a student died outside of my building. And that reminder to them that we can do this, but it takes the will of the legislature right now at the end of the session to recognize the need and invest in the services. For our district, for an intermediate district, that's innovative mental health grants. The partnership, intensive partnership that I mentioned earlier with the Wilder Foundation, will not be able to be funded unless the legislature approves the money in the education bill to do so. School-based mental health services need to be expanded, as NAMI has been so wonderfully advocating for over the years. Mm-hmm. Those investments matter right now, and it's on the legislature to recognize and make the right decision.
Our time is up for now, and we will continue this conversation on another day. But I want to thank all of our listeners who called in, and I want to thank our guests. We've been talking with Sandy Levin-Dusky, the superintendent of Intermediate District 287 here in the Twin Cities, as well as Daniel Newitz, the legislative chair of the Minnesota School Psychologists Association, as well as a licensed psychologist, and Sierra Grandy, a volunteer with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Minnesota, NAMI, where she facilitates several peer support groups through NAMI. Again, the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255, or use the crisis text line by texting HOME to 741-741. Thank you for joining us today. This conversation was produced by Samantha Matsumoto. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder that if you want to catch my show in real time, tune in and call in weekdays at 9 a.m.